You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
Ladies and gentlemen, Vanessa Tyson is our guest, and she's been into politics since she was 12 years old, went to Princeton, studied politics there, did her grad, split her graduate work between Harvard and University of Chicago, I believe, lightweight institutions. And she worked for the Gore-Lieberman campaign, for the Gore campaign, et cetera. You are a political insider, as it were. We want to talk to you about how politics works. So talk to us about your journey.
Goodness. Well, let's see here. Early on, when I was a kid, I just wanted to get involved. I used to watch C-SPAN all the time. Like, C-SPAN started when I was four. You know, by six, we took it on. My mom and I, or rather I did, and my mother refers to my youth as C-SPAN purgatory.
I love that.
Yeah.
Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Whittier, California. My mom was a single parent. I was an only child. And so, you know, Wow. Kind of a bit of a latchkey kid. And I'm a first-generation college graduate, which is why it's hilarious to now be teaching at UCLA, because my mom can come to my classes.
And what do you teach at UCLA?
Political science and African American studies. So this fall, I'll be teaching African American politics. It's an upper-level course for juniors and seniors. Mm-hmm. I have the winter off, and then the spring, I'll be teaching a seminar called Marginalization and Representation, which is about groups that have been systematically marginalized, women and children, racial minorities, the LGBT community, immigrants. And really looking at the ways in which they have been marginalized, you know, by, you know, the government and by kind of like a larger American mainstream, but also how they're increasingly being included and what that means for the trajectory of American politics.
I want to get into that, too, in this discussion.
By all means.
Yeah. One of the things that somebody wrote to me, a grad student, and he's out of, I think, I'm not sure where he comes from.
I can look it up.
Anyway, but he said, look, you guys, he was black, and he said, where are my people are not being represented on your podcast? I listen to you all the time, but I need some color. And we've reached out to various black intellectuals and things like that, but I just thought
and
to myself,
for some reason, they reject me every single time.
you're just too
Cornel
white.
West was like, no response. You know, Neil deGrasse Tyson, everybody wants right now.
Yeah. Well, let me.
Okay. I have some local people who would be more than happy to talk to
good.
You, and some people, if they were in town, would.
This is why I think it's important.
Can you get us Barack Obama? I heard he's between jobs.
Yeah,
so
but he's kind of busy. Not yet, but this is. This is why it's important to me. Is it, you know, when you talk about being marginalized, I mean, there's a reason there's a black ghetto in every city in this country. Is it because black people want to live in just together really tight in a bad area? No, it's the legacy of redlining. It's a legacy of gerrymandering and kind of like, you know, let's get those people over there. You could not get a mortgage if you wanted to live, if you were a person of color, especially black, but it also was Latino, but especially black, if you wanted to live in certain neighborhoods, you weren't getting a mortgage, man, because it would bring your property values down. If a black family moved across, I mean, there really was that idea, there goes the neighborhood, that whole thing. So that is a reality. Mm-hmm. That is a legacy. And we've never really, we don't talk about it enough. It really isn't something that I think is tackled. And what I like about this podcast is I like talking about that stuff front and center, because I think we contend with it every day. I think we're still contending with it. I think that there's a reason that if you look at the, just take a look at the population of inmates, people in foster care, the war zones that are those neighborhoods. They were always starved of resources, and we're still dealing with that legacy and that injustice. And so, I'm not a liberal, man. You're not talking to some liberal white guy with a lot of guilt. I'm just talking about what's fair, and I'm talking about, most importantly, taking a group of people, let's just talk about African Americans for the most part, who have, for the most part, are not being tapped into. That incredible, valuable resource, let's call it 13% of the population, is not being tapped into. Might be right now, if you're a black kid in most neighborhoods in America, your way out is sports. Good luck. So that's 1%, or music, usually rap. That's the other percent. So now you got 2% maybe that make it out, kind of.
Yeah.
And where's,
you think it's 2%?
I don't think
it's anywhere near 2%.
I don't. So what I'm saying. So where is, and some, there's some art, there's some acting, and there's some filmmaking. But for the most part, they're not represented in the business community, in the scientific community.
What about Herman Cain?
Exactly.
Oh, dear Lord.
So we'll talk about that. We'll get into that. Maybe we should get into it now. And then I want to talk about how politics works.
Sure. So, I mean, and I wholeheartedly agree with you, and I'm so glad that you're bringing these, you know, this topic up. When you look at the kind of structural inequality that's gone on in the history of the United States, right, I mean, it's mind-boggling. It is, you know, in many ways, for in an inequality sense, the perfect storm, mm-hmm. right? That African Americans simultaneously were shut out of many occupations, right? I mean, shut out of Social Security, right? Mm-hmm. And how they did so, right? Where it was kind of twofold, right? When you think about the growth of government, right, then you also have to think about who was left out. And they did so, in the Congress, right, you know, did so twofold in the New Deal. What did they do? Well, when you look at Social Security, for instance, right, they specifically excluded, you know, persons who were domestic workers, i.e. maids, you know, chefs, cooks, what have you, butlers. They also excluded farm workers and people working on plantations, right? Mm-hmm. So what did this do? This effectively meant that if you were Black, you weren't going to retire with dignity. In fact, you were going to have to work till you died. Right. That and it meant that you wouldn't have any kind of savings, that you would not be able to, to be caught in this safety net. Right. The safety net did not apply to African-Americans.
Now, what was the rationale at the time
to get it through Congress and to get the Southern Democrats? Right.
Oh,
because you had the one party South.
Okay.
Right. You had the one party South at the time that was all, mm-hmm. Part of the Democratic Party. Mm-hmm. Franklin Delano Roosevelt, in order to get these provisions through, in order to get much of the New Deal through, had to agree to certain demands by, Southerners who were, very intent on preserving the Southern way of life.
Mm-hmm. Right? Slavery.
Exactly. And slavery by another name, if you will. But so... So what happened was there's kind of a twofold approach that these Southern Democrats took in Congress. One was, that we are going to create the policies and put in place provisions within the policy, language within the law that would allow for the exclusion of African Americans. Right. So that African Americans would not make any substantive gains. The second, however, which was possibly more insidious in certain ways, was that, that they were going to make all of these newfound programs state run. Mm-hmm. Right. Which meant that the states would get block grants. Right. They would get, allocations of money. But then it was up to the state to decide, well, how much do we want? How much will I, allocate? Right. So even with welfare provisions, we create welfare as part of the Social Security Act of 1935. What we find is that, that this was going to be allocated and, distributed by the, state governments. So states like, for instance, the national average per child per month was around $14, right? That was the national average, and it was roughly administered so in the South. What you found was that Southern states, what they did was that they said, if you were a Black child, you get roughly $3 to $4 a month, right? And these $3 to $4 a month was what they had, what African Americans had to live on, mm-hmm. if you were a widow, for whatever reason. And meanwhile, if you were a white child, that brings up the white average considerably up to more like $18, $19 per month, right? So what you see is this kind of, these two insidious forms. One is that, provisions were written into law, mm-hmm. that could deliberately exclude African Americans through various means, such as excluding maids, excluding butlers, chauffeurs, plantation workers, and the like. But simultaneously, you have state implementation and state distribution of resources, which were extraordinarily draconian and highly unequal.
So we're still dealing with that legacy in a way. And I think there are a lot
of people. In a way, I think we absolutely are. No, that's the thing. I mean, you mentioned before the podcast, we talked to Freeway Rick Ross, who was one of the largest crack dealers in America.
Yeah.
And, he was saying, the fundamental issue for him was that he never learned to read. And so, even though he played tennis and could have gotten all these college scholarships, he couldn't get college scholarships because he couldn't read.
Right. And my feeling is that, yes, we could talk a long time about all those injustices. Sure. I'm interested in what do we do? What are we doing right now? What are we doing wrong to make this to make this problem, to equal the playing field?
You know, and I think that's, I mean, I think A, that's an important question, and B, it's, you know, part of this is an issue of empathy versus apathy, right, that we see in the United States, right, which is...
Well, let's not even count on empathy, right, because...
No, I don't count on empathy to save my life. It's mostly just apathy.
Yeah.
But I think that, you know, that it's a lack of empathy that leads to this apathy. But what I will say is this, right, that first, we have to get past this mindset, you know, this paradigm that's like, well, what happened in the past, we can't do anything about it. That's a crock, right? You can do plenty about it, right? You just have to be willing to do it. And I think that, you know, we're not seeing that, you know, I mean, we don't see a majority that is willing, you know, by a majority, I'm not talking white people, black people, I'm talking a majority of voters, I'm talking a majority of legislators and what have you, who are actually willing to engage the idea that we need to do something, right? I think one of the first things you need to do is start realizing that there is such a thing as white skin privilege, right? There is such a thing as male gender privilege. There's all sorts.
There's prejudice within the black community. I mean, if you're lighter skinned, you know, there's that there. I mean, it's a weird thing.
Yeah.
But yet we voted a black president in, or at least a biracial president.
He's black. We give him that.
I think Samuel L. Jackson.
My mother
with
happens
that.
To be white. I don't hold that against
her. Exactly. You got to give it up, right?
That's a joke.
No, but you're right. You're right. Let's call him black because he is traditionally. Barack Obama would have been black. He would
paper
not have
bag
been.
Rule.
That's
you
it.
Know.
So
Octoroon.
Yeah.
Anyone?
No. So we've come a long way in a sense in our hearts and minds.
Sure.
A lot of white people voted Barack Obama in. And I think we shocked the world when we did so. Mm-hmm. It sent that message out there. But like you said, there's still
you can have all the degrees in the world, right? And yet people still see your color first, right? Or they still see, you know, they look at your phenotypic attributes and they say, and they categorize you in various ways. It's interesting also being an academic because, you know, you see ways in which you feel constantly underestimated. Right. And then if you actually, you know, are articulate, they're like, oh, she's so well spoken.
Yeah.
Like, really?
So condescending.
Yeah. No, it's like, it is condescending, but it also is it's a little heartbreaking in various ways. And people don't
deal
that.
With it every day.
Yeah. Every single day, you know, that they think, well, there's just preconceived notions. And it doesn't matter if, like, I mean, look. Academics on average would probably say that they're pretty liberal, right? But in the day-to-day interactions, what you find out is that, we've all been programmed by these negative stereotypes.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And then how do
it's
we...
It's programming, isn't it?
Exactly. Yeah. Precisely. I mean, which was one of the reasons why I actually very much like Straight A Conspiracy, because it talked about, like, the way that people fall into these paradigms and these mindsets, you know, and that's easy. That's a luxury. Mm-hmm. It's much more complicated to look at people as whole individuals and to try to figure out how we can best help them.
Well, I think that's the thing. I think we have to embrace the fact that we will always stereotype. We just want to make sure that those stereotypes aren't racial.
Well,
like, I want to stereotype
you're right,
you as, like, I mean, I think that's the thing. I mean, you know, Brian and I lived all over the world, and I think a large part of that is, I mean, when you move around and you see, like, each culture has their own weird prejudices. Like, racism is the American one, we think, but it's actually not. Like, I can tell you horrific stories where they're much more, in places like Libya, they're racist and open about it because they don't see it as a problem. Whereas here, we try and cover it up.
Oh,
you know,
sure.
So,
well, human beings have always, look, slavery was a worldwide phenomenon up until probably really 150 years ago or less. I mean,
it really comes down to this. Like, until we start thinking of ourselves as human first and in terms of our grouping second, none of these problems will be solved.
But by the way, that is going to, I think, eventually happen. I want to get more practical.
Yeah.
You know, you're involved in politics.
Sure.
What my feeling is that, you know, you've got groups of people that are being sort of marginalized. We can go through all the reasons. I want to know practical things. I've always had this fantasy of starting a school. I want to start, like, Andre Agassi and Steffi Graf opened a school in Vegas for underprivileged kids. Mm-hmm. And it's doing really well. That's a fantasy. Like,
sure.
You just want to go into these places and go, here you go. I'm gonna create this school, and you're coming here from the morning to the nighttime, and everything is gonna be taken care of. I know that's crazy, but there are people who are trying to do stuff like that.
Yeah, there are people like Jeffrey Canada and the Harlem Academy and all of that sort of stuff.
Sure. I mean, I actually serve on the board of the Jefferson Awards for Public Service, right, which is a national nonprofit that, you know, really, you know, I mean, we operate across the country, but we have, you know, major events to specifically highlight people who are, you know, and groups and even high schools that are very active in trying to champion public service. It's a nonpartisan group,
right?
We, you know, what we want is people who actually want to help each other, who want to help the world around them, who want to make it a better place. We've partnered, amongst other organizations, we've partnered with the NFL, for instance, to, you know, to work with at-risk youth, right? Particularly inner city youth, because, you know, you have these role models who are there. You know, I'm there as a, you know, as a professor, because there's got to be the counter stereotype. And I think that, you know, I mean, one thing I want to say, though, even with relative to straight A conspiracy, is that, you know, on the one hand, while it's not, while some children are being told they're inherently smart, you know, black children through various means are being told they're inherently dumb. They're inherently lazy, right? Like, I love going up to little. I mean, when
that's,
I started,
that's amazing to me, by the way. Let's talk about that.
I mean, like, I've done some work with foster kids in LA, and like I mean, every kid I've ever worked with has like crazy ideas about their brain and what they can do. But when you work with people who are underprivileged, the ideas are that much wilder. Like, I mean, I had a student who, like, I was working with her. She's working on stats or something. And she was just, like, looking at me like I was a space alien. And I was like, what's the deal? What's going on? And she's like, you went to Harvard, right? And I'm like, yeah. And she's like, so you remember everything you've ever heard. And I was like, no.
See, I would have been like, yes, child. That's the difference between you and me. That's why I didn't go to Harvard. I, you know, that's the difference. I would abuse that.
And then you would have, like, taken a spoon, quickly turned around, bent it a little, and be like, look what I did with my mind.
There is no spoon.
Yeah, exactly.
So you just said that. Where do you – what is your experience with that when you
say
that?
I mean, my experience from very early on, you know, was largely that, you know, like, that people underestimated my intelligence, right? Or, I mean, and what I mean to say is this, like, I remember going to, like, a preschool for, like, a day, and this woman was, like, you know, noticed that I was good at sports and said, oh, well, maybe if you, you know, if you practice really hard, you can go to college. And I was like, lady, you know, like, you know, get your ish together, right? Yeah. And, like, my mom actually...
You don't have the brain, but you have the body.
Exactly, right? Yeah. And my mom was hilarious. My mom decided that she was going to put... My mother, who never went to college, right, you know, didn't have much... didn't have any advanced education whatsoever. She decided she was putting white out on my birth certificate and put me into kindergarten a year early.
Oh,
right?
Wow.
Now, this was the interesting thing, was that my mom loved to read, right? My mother always loved to read. So we started reading very early, right? And what that meant, I started kindergarten at 4, but I was already reading. Right? Like, I had already learned basic phonetics and what have you. And, you know, I knew my alphabet and I was just going at it. Right. And and that's one thing about even education is the more words you learn and you obtain by age 5, there is a great book called Meaningful Differences that actually talks about this, that the more, you know, language you glean by age 5, the better you'll be able to express yourself, you know, down the road, right? And and in multiple ways, which means even, you know, kids who have higher intelligence when they're, you know, if they're subject to trauma, right? What you found, and by higher intelligence, I don't mean, you know, anything inherent. I mean, having been exposed to more words and a better ability to connect and express. As a result, they're much more able to vocalize their, what it is that they're experiencing, right? Like, and that was one of the lucky things for me. When you think about kind of what kids go through on a day-to-day basis with stereotyping, right, and what they learn even from watching TV, right? Like, I think it's amazing that Neil deGrasse Tyson is, you know, it has the show Cosmos, right? I want every black kid to watch that, right? Because it's the counter stereotype.
Well, because what you're talking about is there is evidence out there and there is example out there to change belief structures.
Sure.
And what we're dealing with is a belief structure, that inherent belief structure that let's just talk about African-American kids in
sure.
general.
Yeah.
And there is a way to change that belief structure. What are we doing to get those messages out there?
Well, we're doing the Brian Callen Show. That's really...
Amongst other things,
yeah. A lot of underprivileged kids listen to this show.
One of the things that I've always felt as well, and I'd love to hear what you think about this, is that a large part of it is there needs to be a counter-narrative. Because the problem is that people look at, you know, they're like, Africa's poor, Black people are poor. What's up? Like, something's clearly going on. And the only two ways that, I mean, I remember that when I read, you know, right before I started college, Guns, Germs, and Steel by Jared Diamond. And it was like such an emotionally cathartic experience because suddenly you're like, oh my God, I could never explain it before except in essentially racist ways where you're either saying white people have no soul or Black people are dumb. It's one of the two things.
Yeah. Sure.
And so, you know, I mean, that's the thing. I think counter-narratives like that, and then Why Nations Fail by Darren S. Moglen and James Robinson, and then also Charles C. Mann, who did a great job in 1493 of basically showing how malaria was a large reason why, you know, slavery in particular was African.
Yeah.
Right. So I think that's the thing. I think what's a large part of what's missing is a narrative of how slavery happened that isn't just about innate ability.
Yeah. Oh, certainly. Yeah. Right. I mean, it's all sorts of circumstances. It's the fact that, like, you know, people repeat patterns. Right. So once a pattern goes into place, you know, that becomes a key source of
You know, though, I don't think those ideas are lost on the educated, Black and white. I think that those ideas have to permeate down to the people on the people contending with these problems in real
time. You gotta rock the boulevard.
Yeah, that's what I mean. It's like I'm sorry, but I do these experiments in my head where I'll be on a train or I'll be on a plane and I walk through and I see who's actually reading and who's not. And you can delineate it a lot of times by, you know, you've got Asian and white people for the most part, I notice, reading.
Yeah.
I don't see enough of that in Latin and Black people. I'm sorry. I'm just being honest.
No,
do these. Now, that's a very you know, personal thing. It doesn't mean I'm making it doesn't mean that's true because I don't fly enough. I haven't done, you know, primary research on a large scale. But the fact of the matter is I pay attention to these kinds of things because they matter to me.
Sure.
And I like talking about them because we still have – that's where the inequality – that subtle inequality.
Sure.
The idea that there isn't maybe it's the I feel like some people don't put education at a premium because they feel like there's no point anyway.
Oh, granted. I mean, but also that I think that there's, I mean, when you think about when you start reading, and I don't know when you all started reading or why, like, I loved fiction books. I mean, at first it was Where the Wild Things Are, which we had to read along with like four or five other books, right? But, you know, like, as I got older, I mean, there weren't a lot of books about people who looked like me. There weren't a lot of books that were being championed as Newbery Award winners or Caldecott medals, right? This is an American thing. That had people who looked like me. And I think that, like, I mean, that does lower your self-esteem, or at least it did for me.
Yeah, man.
Right?
Because, how could it not?
You know, and don't get me wrong. Like, I loved Anne of Green Gables, right? I was constantly falling out of trees. I was a mess, and I was a soccer player, which, you know, meant I was a mess regardless.
Like, right.
Continued that on into college.
Did you play soccer in college?
Yeah, for a bit. But then I played rugby, and we were national champions.
Oh,
so,
damn!
You
don't look like a rugby player. You're very pretty.
I was a wing.
Okay.
I was a wing. It's like the equivalent of, like, a wide receiver.
Okay,
you're just out there running.
Yep.
Which is good. But, yeah, so, you know, I think it was something where if I had had more books about people who looked like me or maybe people who felt like me, right? Because I think that was something that also wasn't, you know, elucidated in the books that I read. I mean, at least Anne Shirley felt out of place, you know, and she was adopted and she, you know, she wasn't really pretty, but she wasn't ugly. She was somewhere in between. You know, I mean, all these, that was stuff that I could relate to, even though she had either red hair or auburn hair, depending upon who you asked.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so, but it, you know, she didn't quite fit in, and I liked people who didn't
reading, you still felt like an outsider. There wasn't,
But there are ways in which I think that you could incorporate much more into books that would really bring it alive. And I was talking about this with one of my best friends from grad school. She teaches at University of San Francisco. She happens to be Chumash, so she's Native American, and Native Californian even.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we were talking about what to have her daughter read. You know, I was up visiting them earlier this summer,
mm-hmm.
And you know, just because we want Chanhee, who is half Chumash and half Korean, mm-hmm. right, to have like people like her, mm-hmm. right? We want, you know, we want these role modeling starts so early on, and it's not just your parents and it's not just your family, right? It starts in the ways that we escape, right? Whether it's through movies, books, you know, various media.
Yeah.
And so how do we do this? So you're talking about, like, you know, especially in terms of empowering Black youth, right? And we need a lot more money put into education, right? And a lot more money put in, you know.
I can just hear a lot of people saying, I can just hear a lot of people on the right saying, sounds like a big government program, and where's that money going to go to, and what does that mean? So okay. Let's talk about that, because you're in government.
Yeah. No. And so number of things that I would do. First is that you have to empower public libraries. Right. I mean, my library back home in Whittier, right? My mom and I, we've been working on a program, setting up a program where, you know, retirees work with kids after school, teaching them to read for free. Mm-hmm. Right. Because retirees have a lot more free time than, you know, I do per se. Mm-hmm. Depends upon how you look at it. And then, you know, at the same time, you know, they have a role and they have a purpose that they can contribute. Like,
well,
my mom...
and they need a role and they need a purpose, because that's the biggest thing is that, you know, overwhelmingly, like, yeah. people who have a purpose live longer. The best thing, you know, there's the classic study where they gave all these retirees a plant. And then, like, they were responsible for watering the plant, taking care of the plant, and all that sort of stuff. And then they took the plant away from some people, and they died.
Oh, Jesus. Really?
It's serious. Yeah. It's serious.
What a sick experiment.
Oh, my God, that's awesome.
Yeah. I mean, you know, and we see this time and time again, yeah. that when elderly people, I mean, talk about marginalization. You can't talk about marginalization in the United States without talking about the elderly.
Right.
Right. And so... Yeah, and I teach about this in my classes, so bear with me, I'm a professor in motion. But, you know, that the elderly tend to be the most displaced once they are retired, right? It seems as though they're cast away. Now, luckily, they have a strong voting block, right? And I mm-hmm. say this because my mom also helps run the polls.
Luckily
in my hometown.
Or terribly.
Yeah,
I mean, right. you know, you look at the things that the AARP is now pushing through. I mean, you know, the trillion-dollar Medicare bill that Bush was responsible for, that wasn't a good thing.
Yeah.
No, granted. Okay.
Yeah, but I know
what
you mean. Yeah.
But, I mean, in terms of, like, utilizing resources and making them mm-hmm. available, you know, like putting, I mean, you know, I was very lucky. I didn't know my grandparents very well on either my mother's side or my father's side biologically, but I had this amazing babysitter who had, you know, who'd gone to college. She went to Occidental, right? But she was raising, you know, she had a son and she basically would take care of me during the day, right? Mm-hmm. Now, her mother became grandma to me and her father became grandpa to me. And grandma would read with me all the time and take me to swimming lessons and what mm-hmm. have you. And grandpa taught me chess.
Wow.
Right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so I was incredibly lucky through, you know, because there were these elderly people, like grandma would come and pick us up, Stephen, Michael, and myself, right? Marianne's two sons, my babysitter's two sons. She would pick us up, take us to swimming lessons, cheer for us. Like,
exposed you to the art of learning in a way.
Exactly.
Exposed you to different models
and
taught you how to achieve it something.
And more importantly, taught you that you could.
Yeah.
And taught me that I mattered.
Yeah.
That I was important. And mm. and I think that was something, you know, and these happened, grandma happened to be old, wealthy, white lady.
So taking money and putting it into education and that
yes.
in terms of getting, first of all, programs like that, empowering public libraries.
Utilizing resources that we already have in place.
Okay.
And utilizing the human capital that we have that we're not, like, taking
right.
any advantage of.
But let me ask you this.
Example.
Why do you need money for that? Because that's the thing. You're talking about human capital and you're talking about an attitude shift and you're talking about using the old people that we already have in place. That seems like a psychological shift that needs to happen in this country rather than a resource problem.
Oh, I agree.
Yeah.
I agree wholeheartedly. I mean, but I mean, it's more of like a... I mean, in terms of human capital, I see human capital as a resource, right? That is being
yeah.
underutilized. So I'm not necessarily talking dollars and cents, but I am talking about, like, you know, programs.
Money does talk, though.
Yeah, but money does talk, but I think we get blinded by the power of data and the power of money and the power of government. Because the problem is that, I mean, you know, like, speaking from the perspective of education,
yeah.
like, it's really, really simple. Like, how you learn is by looking at your mistakes, analyzing them, and using them to get better. And the thing is that's an attitude shift. Like, what we deal with on this show, what the Straight A Conspiracy is about, a large part of it is psychological.
Oh, totally.
Now, there are programs that might be able to, you know, bring that about, like Head Start or whatever it may be.
Yeah.
But I think in general, Like the reason why we don't act now and why we don't act today is because we are waiting for Superman. And we are waiting for some massive government program to be created or some transformational figure to be elected. And the power to change these things is in our hands today. You don't have to wait for anything. You can set up your own program like you and your mom did. You can, I mean, like, that's the thing. Like, if you're a retired person, go do it now. Pick one kid, work with that kid. Done.
Yeah. I mean, and that's the thing, is that, like, I mean, and I say this, you know, because this actually was an idea that came out of my marginalization and representation class a couple years ago, right? And I, you know, and the kids and I were talking about my students, but I mean, when you get kids thinking outside of the box, it's amazing, you know, because one of the students was taking, you know, a class called Managing Death, and then he was also taking my class on marginalization. And when we started talking about the elderly and what have you, he just took off. It was like, it was something that he picked up on, and he was like, well, why couldn't you do this, this, and this? And I was like, I don't know.
Yeah.
Right? You know, like, so to give it, you know, this was, I must give credit where it's due, or at least not take the credit myself, but I called my mom that night, right? And I was like, Mom, what do you think about this? And she was like, oh, I think everybody would love it, right? She was like, let me talk to my book club about it, right? Like, I mean, that was the way this, you know, this idea gets started, was simply, you know, that, like, you know, a kid in my class thinking outside the box, right? Like, and he happened to be a Republican. Right.
You know, but let me so take
some
me
of my
through.
Best friends are Republicans.
So take so
no,
so,
but I mean, like,
but on that, I mean, Republicans typically would say, well, that's not a government problem, or whatever. But let take me as somebody who's been on the inside of politics.
Sure.
Take me through the process and the step by step process. So I say I'm a congressman. And I want to make a difference.
Sure.
And I take a neighborhood and I say, I want to empower black youth as an example.
Yeah.
And I wanna empower my public libraries, and let's take two other steps he wants to do. I don't know, create an after school program and more sports. More sports and more art in the community. How would I do that? Just theoretically.
All right. Well, I mean, one thing I will say is that there's a congressman, Representative Bobby Scott from Virginia. Absolutely brilliant man. Represents the area of Newport News. Happens to be African American. Also is a quarter Filipino. So hence he's the first Filipino elected to Congress ever. Filipino American. And he's had, you know, at least legislation, you know, that he's tried to get through multiple times called the Youth Promise Act. Right. And the Youth Promise Act, you know, incorporates a lot of, a lot of this stuff, including after school programs for kids. What you see, however, is that, you know, even like many even within the Democratic Party and various instances have undermined the idea, like, programs for kids,
right?
Because they do cost money.
Mm-hmm. But it's not just cost money. If you had, say, he gets his act through, and you had a program, the government says, "Here's the program. Here's money for a program."
Yeah.
Then what I always worry about is, who's managing that program? Who are the people that are getting hired? Who is hiring those people? Who is overseeing the entire project? Because it's hard to manage that kind of thing on a federal state level. You're a federal politician. You're too busy raising funds and things. So now you've pushed through this legislation. It's a program.
Yeah.
It's out there in the community.
Yeah.
But who the hell is going to run it? Who's going to hire and fire people who aren't effective and who are effective?
And has the government shown itself to be responsible with the money that it has been allocated?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, you can point to plenty of evidence that they have been responsible. You can point to plenty of evidence that they haven't been, right? Like, you know, it's hit or miss here. I mean, first off, in terms of, like, the actual way that you would get it through, you would have to get it through appropriations, right? And, you know, especially when you look, for instance, at a period of the 1990s, right? Bill Clinton was rather comfortable using the line item veto until it was finally deemed unconstitutional by the Supreme Court in 1998, right? Mm-hmm. So what you saw was, you know, a new Democrat, right, who would cut out, like, would specifically use a line item veto and cut out, you know, various programs that cost money, right? So on the one hand, he was very much about balancing a budget. But on the other hand, you know, what you found was that he would rather, you know, cut costs than include programs that would actually help kids, right?
For instance, was kind of the national trend. I mean, big government doesn't solve problems, sometimes it makes the problem worse.
Sure. And
that's
this is a
philosophy.
Shift, and this is a shift that really started with Reagan, right?
Yes.
And I think the thing is, though, is that you can enhance, you know, like what I would do, say if I were a member of Congress, right, is that I would start pilot programs in various cities, you know, so that you can have trial runs before you, you know, with the that would sunset, right? You set a sunset date, so it would like a trial run of 10 years that includes a study, you know, like around year 8, right, that says, you know, whether or not this is working, what, you know, where are the kinks, how have we changed this and what have you, with the idea that you could, you know, reauthorize and or, you know, expand this program.
The problem with that is that, you know, there's a cottage industry that grows up around those kinds of things sometimes.
Sure.
So all of a sudden you get a lobbying effort and it's very hard to kill those programs. And
sure.
Before you know it, you're spending a fortune.
Well, I mean,
and also, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, you know, we're big fans of Lawrence Lessig.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's the question is, without fixing campaign finance, isn't inevitably anything going to get distorted and twisted? And
it's going to be horrible. Yeah,
you're going to have Heinz Ketchup saying, it's not just that ketchup's a vegetable, it's that that's the only thing you ever need to eat. And then you'll just get big plates of ketchup.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we can talk about big ag for
but
days.
But before we get into that, talk about the Appropriations Committee, because does the government have a mechanism by which they guarantee or they oversee how these programs are run?
Yeah. Well, okay. So basically, yes, they do, but we have a 3-branch system, right? So the judges are usually out of it for the most part, right? Mm-hmm. But there's a back and forth usually between the administration and, you know, which includes all of the different, you know, agencies, et cetera, and Congress, right? So what do you have? So you get through the Appropriations Committee, right, which is where basically money is spent. They decide how much money is going to go where, right?
Who sits on that? Congressmen?
Yeah, members of Congress. So the Appropriations Committee, you have an Appropriations Committee on the House side, you have Appropriations Committee on the Senate side, right? And they will eventually pass roughly what is 13 bills, right? And 13 bills go to the 13 major agencies, Health and Human Services, Education, Department of Defense, Veterans Affairs, and so on and so forth, Commerce, Energy, you dig? So they'll have these bills, right? But now they have to be – now the House may pass one bill. One version. The Senate may pass another version. But in order for the bill to go to President Obama to be signed, they have to be identical, right? Which means that what happens is after they pass the House and the Senate, you know, members of the House and the Senate then go into conference, right? And what I've found from talking to any number of members of Congress, particularly the minorities, right, is that it's in conference when they're coming up with an identical piece of legislation. That's where the funding often gets thrown out, particularly for issues that, you know, like for programs that would benefit minority communities.
So the senators and the congressmen sit in a room, hash it out until they come up with something they all agree on, in theory. And then they present it to the president.
Yes, and usually there's someone from the administration and there's usually representatives from various agencies, right, in terms of hashing out even details of how a particular piece of legislation might work, depending upon what we're dealing with, who will say, like, either represent the president's, you know, stance, or, you know, like, because you don't want to veto, that won't do you any good after all this, you know, time and energy, and also the administration, like people from the agencies who will say, look, you know, like, you should probably rewrite this like this in such a way so that you have A, B, and C, so that because that will be the easiest and most cost effective way to implement it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Mm-hmm. But with the Appropriations Committee, you know, then Barack Obama will get 13 bills to sign, not necessarily all 13 at the same time. Right. You know, and sometimes you can't get it through at all, which is what happens when you get a government shutdown because the government is no longer spending money because they haven't approved, you know, the appropriations bills to spend money.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So from there. Right. Then it goes into the implementation process, which is where the agencies, right, the Department of Defense, the Department of Commerce, the Department of Education, that's where they take up, you know, these programs and put them into place. Congress from there has oversight, right, which means that they can, you know, request that these, you know, secretaries or like, you know, the EPA administrator or whomever, right, comes and testifies to them about how it's going. Right. Most of the congressional committees, be it on the Senate side or the House side, actually have like specific oversight subcommittees. Mm-hmm. Right. Right now. And then you have like a larger government reform and oversight committee, which is run currently by Daryl Issa from like the San Diego area, I believe. Orange County, Southern California, somewhere there. And so you have this process. the question is, you know, and there's work been done on this about the bureaucracy in general, right? The bureaucracy has about 4 million individuals working for it, of which about, you know, over 2 million, maybe like 2.3 million, 2.4 million are non-civilian. This is like armed forces, a Department of Defense and the Department of Veterans Affairs are the largest bureaucracies, right? There's, when you look at how much money goes into defense versus how much money goes into education and health and human services, it's
pretty astounding.
It's staggering.
Yeah.
Right. Because I mean, you know, money does talk, and where you allocate and how you distribute your money says so much about where your values are, right?
Yeah, but the United States is also in a unique position in the sense that it is responsible for keeping the sea lanes open. Like, we have the largest aircraft carrier fleet in the world, and if we didn't spend that much money on defense, or at least some percentage of that money, then, well, guess what? The global trade system would shut down. And I mean, I'm
struck, though, by the difference in philosophy here. It's very interesting. You know, you teach government. You've been in government a long time.
Sure.
And there is a place for government, of course. And so yes. you're talking about, as I'm listening to how government works and all the different steps and stuff, and then, you know, you create a program that's supposed to make things better. Man, oh man, is that a gamble? And I think that then you know, you look at Hunter who's talking about this is a problem of psychology, a problem of belief structure. And I know you agree with that as well. And there's got to be a middle ground there. And I feel like stepping just outside of government and getting into those communities in another way, or just...
Sure.
I think the problem is that, you know, it's not that the two are not necessarily mutually exclusive.
No.
Like for me, I believe in the scientific method. I think that if possible, you should always be dealing with things that have been empirically proven. Well, you know, if you're hungry, you can't think. Like, school lunches make sense because you can't have education if
that's
the
right.
kid is starving all day because you're wasting
your money.
If you
have hookworm and it makes you anemic,
so,
which is what was going on in the South back in the day.
Right.
Yeah. That was a scourge, and you're not going to be able to concentrate. You can't have half the population suffering from malaria, and that's why mosquito nets are so important.
Right.
Sure.
So, I mean, the thing is, it's not that the two, it's one or the other. And that's a large part of what I'm talking about. Part of our problem is that we think it's one or the other.
Right.
And very often what ends up happening is that, you know, if you're in Washington, if you're in government, if you're in the school system, you're abundantly aware of the funding problems. And so you think the solution is funding, 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 funding. But there's procedural stuff that we can do that is cheap. That is,
well, it's like
or
Vanessa
free.
Was saying, the infrastructure exists already.
Exactly.
Use what's already there.
Exactly.
Well, yeah. But at the same time, I'm not trying to say that there shouldn't be more funding made available. And let me talk about why. So when I was in grad school, you know, I'm at Harvard, and, you know, I started a program teaching self-esteem to girls in lockup, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I started it actually because I had been working I was one of the founding members of the Survivor Speakers Bureau for the Boston Area Rape Crisis Center. And I had toured all over New England. My father is a convicted pedophile. And
a thing to drop in conversation.
Sorry. Yeah. I mean, it is what it is.
Yep. Yeah.
You know, whatever. But so I was I toured all over New England talking about what had happened to me as a child and how it had affected me, you know, as a kid, how it affected me as an adult and all this stuff. But one of the places that I liked most when I was sent to talk was actually at this girls' detention center, because so many of them had been through what I had been through.
Mm-hmm.
And they, I mean, or even worse in terms of, like, I can tell you stories for days. But and I realized I wanted to go back, right? I realized that, like, maybe like something good could come of what I had, you know, experienced. And so I went to work with these girls. I started this program with the Department of Youth Services, teaching self-esteem to girls in lockup. And I was lucky that I had flexible time that I could do this, right? I mean, the thing is that, you know, like, I grew up, we didn't have any money. We reused paper towels, right? Like, you know, we never got any support from my father. And then, you know, it's a long story, but then he was in prison. That wasn't going to help either.
Yeah.
But my mom was this very loving person who taught me how to care for people and taught me how to, like, try to help them and help them believe in themselves, right? When everybody else had told them that they weren't worth anything.
Mm.
And that was something that I really wanted to convey to these girls, that they were worth something. You know, because one of the things...
How did you do that?
Well, so I started this program. I went there once a week, you know, all day once a week. You know, it was Mondays, then it was Tuesdays. You know, depends upon, like, because I was also a TF, a teaching fellow, which is like a TA at Harvard.
Insists upon renaming normal things weird things. Like, it can't just be like, what's your major? Yeah. It's what's your concentration? Oh, thanks, Harvard.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, like, it's like so unnecessary.
Yes, no, this is a recurring thing. Yeah. It's okay. Princeton calls them preceptors.
That's like military guys. Instead of saying fighting the enemy, we engage the enemy.
Yeah. Exactly, right? These new terms with, you know, similar
new
meanings.
Speak.
So I started reading up all on self-esteem, right? Mm-hmm. Because, you know, like I mean, all the psych work and so much of everything is psychological. It's emotional. It's about how we feel about ourselves, how we feel about ourselves in the world around us.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went in and I started working. We had group, mm-hmm. right? And I would work with them, you know, one afternoon a week after they were done with classes,
mm-hmm.
right? To try to identify positive role models, to try to learn to talk about their emotions and not act out on their emotions, to try to figure out, like, you know, I mean, what were the types of things that make them angry? What were their triggers? You know, I remember one time they asked me if I had ever done drugs, and I was like, no, right? Because
that big smile, I wish that everybody could see that. Yeah. No.
No, like, I mean,
nerd, beat it,
I know,
nerd.
I was a nerd.
Beat it, Harvard nerd.
You were a nerd?
But she's a pretty nerd, I'll tell
she's
you that much.
Nerd. Yeah.
To say the
details,
least. Yeah, yeah.
Details.
Yeah, details. Smart and pretty.
But yeah, so what I worked with them on was kind of like why they were making the decisions they were making,
mm-hmm.
right? You know, which it sounds like if you were doing work with foster kids, that's the same thing that you're really doing, is trying to think about, like, to actually make them present. Right, where they're actually thinking about why am I doing what I'm doing.
Well, it's all metacognition. It's thinking about your own thinking, so that you're not just acting habitually, but you pay attention to it, and then you can unravel it.
So the
National Academy of Sciences, right? They go through all that we know about learning, right? Mm-hmm. And the National Academy of Sciences is the premier scientific organization in the United States, arguably in the world, right?
Yeah.
They go through everything we know about learning. And what you find is a recurring motif, right, just comes up again and again and again and again, is metacognition.
Mm-hmm.
All that effective learning, all that behavior change really is about is thinking about your own thinking.
Mm-hmm.
So rather than just acting through habit, you stop, look, listen, and figure out why you're doing the things that you're doing, and then you have the potential to change it. The thing is
this what you worked with these mm-hmm. these girls?
Well, like one thing is called cognitive behavioral therapy.
Yeah, CBT.
CBT,
to
right.
its friends.
Right? So what I wanted them to do was kind of really think about what they were feeling and why, right? And then some days, like one day we had a speech contest, for instance, and I was working with, you know, they all had their different speeches and stuff like that. Some, you know, one girl wasn't writing, right? Well, this was a girl named Lily. And, you know, her big brother was one of the drug kingpins in the Boston area. And she never learned how to read. She dropped out of school basically in third grade and she was running drugs for her brother,
mm-hmm.
right? And so she had never learned how to read. And I was like, okay, you know, like that, you know, not knowing how to read doesn't mean you can't give a speech. And I actually had them listen to Martin Luther King. I had them listen to Malcolm X. I had mm-hmm. them listen to various speeches that, you know, like, and then I wanted them to write their own I Have a Dream speech, right? What is this, you know, what do you want to see? And I want you to relate it to your own life, right? You know, I'm not talking about everything in America. I'm talking about what you see on the day to day. What do you want to change, right? Well, Lily won the speech contest. I mean,
mm-hmm.
she got standing ovation for everybody
mm-hmm.
because she broke it. Completely impromptu. I mean, she thought about it.
Yeah, of course.
Right.
Well,
those are seminal moments, man. They changed. They changed.
And
everything.
I mean, the kids roared with applause. I roared with applause because she broke it down. She was like, no, you know, like, I want kids to live in a safe place where there aren't gunshots. Right.
Mm-hmm.
She talked about her life and it was phenomenal. Right. And what she.
But so let's talk about that. Like, that's a very measurable goal, right?
Yeah.
I have a friend of mine from college, and she taught for a long time in Dorchester, Mass, right?
Yeah.
Just not a great...
Dorchester.
Yeah, it's not necessarily the safest.
Some of my girls were from Dorchester.
Yeah.
Mattapan.
Yeah.
You know, yeah.
But one of the things she would talk about is that, you know, if a door would slam down the hallway, she would lose most of her students for the day because to them it reminded them of a gunshot or, you know, all of that sort of stuff. And so they'd be in that state of fear or anxiety for the rest of the day and they couldn't think clearly,
exactly.
right?
Exactly.
But so let's talk about something like that, okay. Like a community.
And it's worth noting that the government did a really good job, especially the police force in Boston and stuff, of really taking the juvenile murder rate and just decimating it. I mean, they did a great job. I think there was like they went from some crazy number like 300 to two or something, So that is an example of where the government has a role.
But even bringing this back a bit, so I was doing all of this work, right, both for the Rape Crisis Center and as well as for the, as well as for the Department of Youth Services, but I wasn't getting paid, right? I was having a hard time. I mean, luckily gas was cheaper,
No, you need money, man.
What I'm saying is, you have people who are very devoted, who, this is...
They got to pay their rent.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. And I was lucky that my teaching fellow stipend and, now I have a whole bunch of educational debt helped me pay my rent.
But then I start thinking, Vanessa, about how the hell we turn that into some kind of a profit industry. Like there's got to be a way to create an incentive structure where money going into that program is creating money. I don't know how you do that.
Well,
but this
I get cynical
about the powers that be are not going to really.
And the thing is that while they're that's the problem is, listen. There are a lot of great teachers out there and there are a lot of people who are really motivated.
Sure.
There are a lot of people for whom it's just a paycheck
who
are abusing the system. And, all the horror stories float out about the teacher who's sitting there and running a real estate business and paying no attention to her kids.
Yeah,
pay
motivated, smart people like yourself.
I mean, I'm not necessarily looking – I don't need $1 million to do that work, right? Nor am I asking for it.
But how are you making sure – that the people who are being paid are really invested and not – for example, teacher tenure, right?
Mm-hmm.
There are all these teachers who have these tenures. It's so difficult to get rid of one.
Yeah.
And then that's the problem is that they're not accountable. At least when you're in something like a charter school system, there's actual accountability there. So, would you, for example, right, one of Brian's questions that he loves to ask is he makes you the emperor of the United States for the day.
Sure.
Do you get rid of teacher tenure?
Empress.
Well, or it's like the word actor. It's now gender neutral.
Athletic, intelligent, pretty. Empress.
Yeah, but so, okay, Empress
day. I have to give it up because you don't look like the
I'm
average.
I'm wearing my glasses.
That's not true. You don't look like the average academic. You're very, very intelligent, obviously, but you also, I just find it impressive that you're that well-rounded. You're also a good athlete, obviously, on a national rugby team that won the Nationals, and you don't... I'm complimenting you. Take the compliment.
Okay, thank you. Nobody ever said I was normal. nobody.
So would you get rid of teacher tenure?
No. But I think I would do a lot of things in terms of, kind of changing up the way tenure works.
Okay.
Right? I think because on the one hand, yes, you want incentives to do a good job. You want incentives to be effective. But simultaneously, teachers need a lot of support that they're not getting. Because basically, what you see in many cases, and so, so Southside Chicago, right? Because I'm obsessed with volunteer work. Southside of Chicago, when I was there for my first 2 years of graduate school, I worked, 3 days a week volunteering at Shoesmith Elementary School. We were the Shoesmith Bumblebees, and I was working in a second grade class. Then I moved up to third grade with my kids.
Mm-hmm.
And the interesting thing about it was that, I was in the classroom all day long, 3 days a week. I was like, man, I don't know how teachers do it. This is tough, tough work, right? Because this is also an impoverished area, right? This is the South Side of Chicago. This is a public school.
Mm-hmm.
Chicago public schools are renowned or infamous or whatever you want to grant them.
Yeah, but Arne Duncan fixed them.
Sorry.
That was a great. Did you hear?
That was
hear
a nice snort.
Did you hear what she just did? Yeah. Now I've never heard a sound like that. I've actually never, especially out of an academic. I beg your pardon, madam.
Yeah.
That's.
Yeah. I do.
Hashtag. Yeah.
Brian, how do you represent that with letters?
Oh my God! I don't care.
Here.
I'm using that. I want that on a loop. Rena, can we get that?
Yeah.
I swear to God, every time I don't like something, I want a button, so I go. Yeah.
It's okay. I also have a stamp for papers that is like a WTF stamp in red ink, right? And if you test me, you will get the WTF stamp.
Yes.
But yeah, so in Chicago public schools, these teachers have so few resources. You have these kids who have been fed nonstop sugar if they've been fed, right? And not only that, but this was, you know, this was 2000 that I started working there. And, you know, you had eight, and I'm working with these 7 and 8 year olds. Well, hi, they were, you know, 8 years before was the maturation of the crack epidemic, you know, across the country, which meant that, you know, you had these kids in school who literally were 8-year-old crack babies, right?
Now, and they're being fed sugar all day.
And, you know, like they haven't had a nutritious diet. They're not getting enough exercise for any number of reasons, including the fact that, you know, the area isn't safe. Right. So they can't go outside and play for real.
Jesus Christ.
You know, I mean, there's all sorts of reasons. I mean, like I said, the perfect storm.
It's like taking a race car and just bashing it into a wall over and over again.
You know, and
yeah, but then putting sugar in the gas tank.
Like I had this
as well.
I had this one little girl named Lauren, and she'd be like, "Uh-oh, Miss Tyson. Uh-oh, Miss Tyson." I was like, "What's going on?" Right? Well, you know, she was adopted. She'd been a crack baby. And she would get these red splotches, and she was like a red splotch. She'd point to the red splotch because within 20 minutes, she would be covered, you know, in these like gargantuan purple spots. I mean, it wasn't even hot it, because they weren't raised, but it was all her whole body had turned purple. Right. And it was just a reaction that we, you know, and she would be in pain. Right. It wasn't itchy, but she was in pain. And, you know, I mean, it was just something that this was the day to day. Now, it's very hard to focus, right, or to keep, you know, a classroom of 36 kids in line, right, when everybody's just watching Lauren get, like purple spot. Oh, there's another one, you know, by the minute. It was one of the most phenomenal things I'd ever seen. Where, I mean, you know, like...
But the important thing to keep in mind is that there are solutions to these problems, aren't there?
Yes, there are. But part of it has to be smaller class size.
Yeah.
That, I mean... Like, there are ways in which I could say, okay, look, if you want to get rid of teacher tenure or if you want to make it a contractual basis where it's like a contract every 5 years or something like that, fine. But it would require more teacher support, right, where teachers aren't trying to...
Well, you're saying that's the least of our problems. You're saying that teacher tenure is been made the bad guy, but you're talking about...
I'm talking about,
I mean,
systemic
fundamental
problems.
It's like when I tried to go work with inmates and the guy, I had all these ideas. And you know what the guy said? He'd been working with inmates for 25 years he's trying to re-assimilate them. He goes, hey, man, these people don't know how to read or write. You're talking about a reading program. I got to get them to read and write. And some of them don't have shoes. That's what I'm dealing with.
Exactly. Well, teachers are dealing with the same thing. It's like, you know, the schools don't have any money, right, for basic supplies, you know, stuff to, you know, pencils, you know, erasers, right, paper, right. I mean, and I've had, I mean, and I've seen it first up close and personal where, you know, you're asking, you know, parents to go out and buy these basic supplies.
But let's be clear, because the I think what's often lost is the United States is usually in the top five in the world in per student spending. So it's not that there isn't money for education, that there's money for education.
It's how it's being spent.
But it's also where it's being spent.
And it's
that's
very top heavy. It's like all these administrators, all these educational consultants, right, you know, who have never, in many cases, especially with these consultants, you know, like who have never spent a day in the classroom. Right. Have never. I mean, don't know the day to day.
On a more fundamental level, like if you look at what's taught in teacher colleges, they're teaching, you know, what Dewey thought about education. I mean, these educational philosophies are over a century old. You know what I mean? And don't take into account the latest neuroscience or the latest psych or anything like that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like so. And, you know, one of a lot of the work that's being done now, which is really, really excellent, is essentially they're like, you go to teacher college, you learn all this theory, and you have no idea how to manage a classroom. And there's a lot of really great work that's being done on classroom management. Like, how do you deal with a kid who's, like, got purple splotches and is distracting everyone? Like, how do you respond to that?
And, but you know, also, like, another thing is, you know, and I've talked to teachers about this. So my babysitter, right, she eventually, like, after her parents were my grandma and grandpa, right, after, you know, we got old enough, she went back to get her master's degree and became a teacher, right, in the third grade class in, you know, my little school district, et cetera. And I would go in and volunteer with her until she just retired last year, and now I'm, like, aimless. but so she, you know, one of the things that she said, like, and I would notice would make a ton of difference compared to the classroom that I was working in on the south side of Chicago, right, was carpet. carpet. I know that sounds silly. I know, you know,
no,
but bear
doesn't.
With me. That, you know, that if you have these little kids in these chairs and desks and you've got 36 kids in a classroom, right, which is crazy, right, they make so much noise just, you know, like moving their chairs back and forth. I know, they're antsy. They're kids. They're supposed to be. If they weren't
carpet.
Wiggling, then they
get
would there'd
carpet
be something
in there
wrong.
Then.
Yeah, but get the it brings down the noise level so much, right?
That's the little things, the mosquito nets, carpeting, that kind of stuff.
Exactly.
That's what I mean by solutions that are already available.
That allows for better teaching and better focus, right? Which is what you need for the kids. I mean, the same thing with having smaller classrooms. It allows, you know, it's more guided in terms of focus, right? That the same thing with, you know, like getting retired people to work with kids, because the more one-on-one time they have, not only are they getting the attention they need, right? But they, you know, they're encouraged to focus and go about, you know, like learning, the process of learning,
We need you back.
Oh, are we
and
done?
And we need, we're
well, it's an hour.
It's an hour, but what I'm saying is that we've talked about education. We need to talk about government.
Of course.
And we need to talk more about this.
Yeah, and the things that I'd really like to get. Yeah, the things I'd really
I'm
like.
I'm here.
All right.
Yeah. The things I'd really like to also get into are some of the sort of the deep structural issues. Like, I'd like to really talk about campaign finance, but also districting. Because I think, like, districting is so freaking nuts. And, like, I mean, you know.
So let's do a four-part interview with
four?
Vanessa Tyson.
Brian, we've never done a four-parter.
Hey, I don't play around, bro.
Brian, that's really
exciting.
I mean,
we're just getting started on these issues. You
yeah,
know?
You've really, like,
but
wow.
I like, we keep it an hour because people don't have time to listen
sure,
to more.
Sure, of course.
And so,
well, that's not true. People always ask for things to be longer.
Well, they say that, but overall, 45 minutes is, you know, it's been proven through my extensive research.
Oh, it has?
Ladies and gentlemen, you've been listening to Vanessa Tyson, who's just scratched the surface, and we'll be back with her. This has been part one of the four-part Vanessa series. It's called the Vanessa Tyson series. I don't know, I'm trying to make it sound really full of gravitas. As always, my colleague, Hunter Motz, peppering in with incredible insight. And I hope I've done a good job of stewarding the ship. I wish my voice was a lot deeper than I wish I had. Perhaps for the rest of the season I'll speak this way. Vanessa, I'm sorry to cut us off. But we need, there's a lot more to talk about. Where can they find you?
Oh, where can you find me? Well, let's see. I'll be at UCLA teaching.
Not physically, like on the. I don't want a bunch of people coming.
Yes, that's probably not a good idea.
I want the pretty rugby player who's smart. I don't want any of that.
No.
Oh, God.
Let's see. You can follow me at Vanessa C. Tyson on Twitter.
Okay.
I think that's probably a good place to find me. You know.
Good.
Yeah. Is that sufficient? What's that? No, I don't have a website. I'm afraid it would give in to narcissism or something.
She's an academic, ladies and gentlemen. She doesn't need a website. That's for actors and comedians who we don't have on this podcast.
No, I just don't want to be an egomaniac.
God bless. Well, you have a lot to say, and we just have more to talk about, more to cover. Did you have a final question?
I mean, that's my final question, is I want to talk about districting.
We'll talk about that next
finance.
Time. And we'll also talk about tax reform. I can make it sexy.
I would love to talk about tax reform because
we'll get a government episode in, you know, because.
Well, but that's the thing, Brian. I mean, who knows where the episode will go? I mean, you know, we don't want to tell people what it's going to be. Tune in next week to find out.
It's like the Nile.
Yeah.
With its thousand estuaries.
But I think fundamentally, what I want to get into is I feel like we need a reset in this country. Like, we need a fundamental rethink of everything from the ground up. We need a new understanding for the public. We need to, like, because, I mean, that's the thing. Even you talk about agriculture. I mean, the stuff that is happening in agriculture is utterly nuts, in large part because of campaign finance.
Yeah. I mean, I first learned about that. I took an agribusiness course when I was at Harvard at the Kennedy School, but joint between the Kennedy School and the business school. I had no idea.
Yeah.
No clue.
It's so nuts.
There's a teaser for
Part
episode.
Three.
Yeah. let's get you back sooner than later, though.
Okay.
Well, what about tomorrow?
Tomorrow's not good. Let's do it when I come back from Utah.
Okay.
You're going to Utah, Brian?
Yeah.
What are you going to do there?
Just live like a man, split wood, drink cappuccino, and hang out at my parents' place. All right.
Okay.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's been the Brian Callen.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.